I just want to welcome you to tonight. I think this is one of the most important men's ministry things that we've done. This is a big issue. John's going to be talking about that. I don't want to take anything away from John, and John will introduce himself because I'll never be able to do him justice. But he's certainly well qualified to do this presentation today. What is the aim of tonight? It's really to educate you in the areas of men's depression and anxiety, and to explain what it is and what it's not, but also to help you what you can do if you think you've got it or a friend's got it. So this is not just about for people that have got it or feel they might have it, but it's also if you know somebody that has, because it's almost certain, I'd say 100% certain you know somebody that is suffering from anxiety or depression.
So Nathan Thompson's story there and that photo of Robin Williams gives us a pretty clear introduction to this problem. I want to highlight a few issues for starters about the severity of the problem. Now, Jeff, I'm supposed to switch this on somewhere, aren't I? Oh, it's on already. Okay. So I work as a consultant psychiatrist, psychiatrists have got a lot of different specialty areas. My specialty area is pretty much mood and anxiety disorders. And I guess I do two broad things. Assessing people for general practitioners and for psychologists in terms of management planning, what kind of thing would be helpful to them, etc. And also doing individual treatment myself, both with psychotherapy and medication. Now, this problem is really a hidden epidemic, and it is an epidemic and it is hidden. And a lot of it is because we men are not too flash about talking to our spouses or friends or GPs about these difficulties. At some stage of their life, about 1 in 8 men will have depression, and I'll come later to what I mean by depression. It's a little bit more nuanced than it appears. And about 1 in 5 experience anxiety. And while these difficulties are more common in women, a major problem is that in men, they're less likely to talk about it. And it increases the risk of depression and anxiety going unrecognised and untreated, which is commonly the case. I guess my first introduction to that actually was when I was 11. And around the corner was a bloke where my father used to play tennis from time to time. A fellow had a tennis court in his backyard. And he was an elder at the church that we went to at that time. And one day, this guy got up. He was a fairly senior engineer with Rio, what was then Rio Tinto, or Consink Rio Tinto, is now Rio. He took his daughter into town with him, as he usually did, went into the car park, dropped her off, drove out the other end of the car park and went up to Sylvan Dam and shot himself in the head, killed himself. There was absolutely no notice that that was a problem with this guy. He was a very well-respected member of the community. He was a very quiet man, which was part of the problem. And no one, not even his wife, as she said later, realised that this was a problem. And that's the first occasion I've become aware of this kind of presentation. Depressive illness is a high risk factor for suicide, and there are about 2,200 suicides each year in Australia on recent figures. 80% of those are by men, an average of 5 men taking their lives every single day of the year. It's the leading cause of death for men under the age of 45, and it exceeds the national road toll. I want to just set out what the take-home messages are from tonight. Two blocks of take-home messages, a block here, and then after we've had something to eat, there's another block of take-home messages. And then I'll spend a bit of time explaining the take-home messages, but I'd like you to see the headlines and to see where I'm going. We need to understand there's a difference between depression as a symptom and depression as a persistent depressive illness. And as Nathan Thompson spoke about there, the group that's a problem is the group who've got a depressive illness rather than just the occasional depressive symptom. Depressive illness may have potentially serious outcomes, obviously with suicide, but many men cover up with work and with alcohol, excessive work and with alcohol. Depressive illness is a syndrome, really. It's a syndrome. It's a constellation, a grouping of symptoms, of both psychological symptoms and physical symptoms. And a lot of them are kind of hidden. They're not obvious. There is a need when a person has this kind of syndrome or thinks they've got this kind of syndrome to talk to someone about it, to talk to a friend, a partner, a pastor, ultimately a good GP, as we'll get to in a few moments. And then after a break, we'll be talking about what we do in terms of assessment of a situation like this, what kind of treatments are available, and there'll be time for some questions, as there will be time for some questions just before the break. So looking at men and depressive illness and suicide, teenagers and older men are particularly at risk, and it's associated with other kinds of illnesses as well, with cardiovascular disease, diabetes as well. And men in particular resort to destructive behaviours often, alcohol, drugs and suicide. It's been a big and concerning problem to the rural community in Victoria and probably in all of Australia, because there have been a lot of people, some of them actually quite senior in the rural sort of lobby groups, who've committed suicide suddenly. There was a guy who was the main representative of one of the rural, the farmers associations in Victoria, who just up and out one day and took his shotgun and killed himself. It's a big problem in the rural community. People with depressive illness, quite a number of people whose names you would know have acknowledged that they have had depressive illness. Some of the people mentioned there have bipolar disorder. Winston Churchill had bipolar disorder. Stephen Fry has bipolar disorder. Spike Milligan actually has bipolar disorder, which might not surprise you given some of his output. Some of the people who've suicided, Tony Hancock suicided in Australia, as you may or may not remember. Some of you of that sort of age who remember Tony Hancock's work on TV, he suicided in Sydney when he was out here on the tour. Ernest Hemingway shot himself. Robin Williams recently hanged himself. Paul Hester, the drummer for Crowded House, hanged himself a little while ago. You don't hear often of these things. The occasions where the trains get stopped, and there was one yesterday, train on the Williamstown line was stopped. They're almost always suicides, that they stop the trains, etc., to clean things up, because I won't show you what happens when someone stands in front of a train and suicides. It's a common problem, and the media actually have an agreement that they won't publicise each of those events because people find it so distressing. The AMA Vice President said a little while ago, I'm sick to death, pardon the pun, I'm sick to death of personally knowing or getting calls about colleagues and friends who've committed suicide. And there have been a lot of senior medical practitioners who've suicided. Dentists actually suicide at a higher rate than doctors, but there are a lot of doctors who've suicided. There was a senior cardiologist in Melbourne 2 weeks ago who suicided very unexpectedly. The CEO of one of the private hospitals not very far from here suicided about a month ago. Mike and I were talking about him just the other day. And you probably know someone who suicided, or know someone who knows someone who suicided. It's a really common and difficult problem. The extent of the problem, it's widespread. Distress and disability, a lot of economic costs. One of Australia's senior psychiatrists was trying to impress upon the World Bank and the UN the seriousness of this problem. And it is considered to be, in 2020, it's supposed to be the second most serious problem internationally, the second most serious health problem internationally. To impress upon them, what he had to resort to was not the distress and disability, but the economic costs. So he had to do calculations about how much it actually costs our community for people being off work, having reduced efficiency, early retirement, sickness benefits, etc., etc. There is a 10 or 15% suicide rate of untreated major depressive disorder if people don't actually go forward to have some sort of treatment. The economic costs are really considerable in terms of days off per month, etc., working days lost, and loss of productivity. So we need to look at what we're actually talking about. What are we talking about when we use the term depression? It's a term that's potentially a bit confusing, partly because some different professional groups use the term and they're talking about different things. Depression can be, it's used as a term to describe a transient feeling. It's used as a term to describe a minor adjustment reaction, and it's also used as a term to describe a major depressive illness, a major sort of syndrome. And symptoms are widespread. Symptoms are multiple, not just low mood, but also tearfulness, insomnia, disturbance of appetite, which can be either up or down, people eating more sometimes when they're depressed, sometimes eating less. No pleasure in life, not getting any enjoyment out of life, irritability, and suicidal thought. Suicidal thought is really a very good marker for people who've got major and serious depression. So we need to be clear what we're talking about then. Depression can be just a feeling, it can be a symptom, it can be a disorder. You might say, okay, so Sydney Swans lost the grand final, so I'm really depressed about that. That's a feeling, yeah? Transient, short, and not of serious nature. When people have a grief reaction, they feel depressed for a short period of time, but that's a symptom. It's not actually a depressive disorder. Or it can be a persistent major depressive kind of syndrome, and the current convention is of 2 weeks' duration. If a person has persistent depressive symptoms for each day for about 2 weeks, that's considered to be a major depressive disorder. So this can be quite difficult to evaluate, and there's a need for careful assessment to clarify what kind of clinical picture the person has. So we need to look at the pattern of depressive symptoms. Psychiatric diagnosis is pattern recognition. So there's a need to look at the pattern of the depressive symptoms. And these are the three major kind of clinical syndromes where people get depressive symptoms. People who are experiencing a grief reaction get a brief dip in their mood, as illustrated there, but it's intermittent and it's fairly shallow. So they feel depressed, but when you look at the picture, the symptoms are mild in severity and they're intermittent. Grief is a normal emotional reaction to loss. Grief is not a psychiatric illness. And that's the kind of picture when you look at someone over a period of weeks or months. The next clinical kind of picture is what you might call adjustment disorder with depression. It's where people have had a particular loss. They might have lost a job. They might have some other loss in their life. And the depressive symptoms may be more severe, perhaps moderately severe, we might say. But they're also intermittent, and the person has gaps in between their sort of depressive episodes, so they might be down for a few days and then they might be fine for a week and then they might be down for a few days, etc. after that. There's some definite triggering factor usually with this kind of group, and the depressive symptoms are intermittent. But the group that's the major concern is major depressive disorder at the bottom of that slide, where the depressive symptoms may still fluctuate, but they're virtually maintained under the surface a bit for at least 2 or 3 weeks. So the person might have some days where they feel a bit better, but they really feel depressed every day for 2 to 3 weeks. And it's considered a disorder because it is persistent and it is severe and it is distressing. And suicidal thought is a good marker for a major depressive disorder. So just the word depression is a problem. I guess doctors, psychiatrists use the term depression, but what they actually mean is a depressive illness, a depressive syndrome, whereas the general public use the word depression in a different kind of way. Most people who would turn up to GPs with depression really have either grief or an adjustment disorder, most of them, but there are some who have a major depressive illness, and it's picking up those ones which it's important for GPs not to miss because it has such a high mortality. So if we just look at a little more then at the depressive syndrome, it's a syndrome, a group of symptoms of behaviours and thoughts and feelings and physical symptoms. So what sort of behaviours? People withdraw typically. They don't go out, they don't get things done, they withdraw from family and friends and from workmates. They stop doing things that they enjoy. They have difficulty concentrating in particular. The thinking that people experience, I'm a failure, it's all my fault. Nothing ever good happens to me. I'm worthless. Life's not worth living. Going on sometimes then to formulated plans about how a person might take their own life. So in assessing people like this, we always ask whether they have formulated plans and whether they've, you know, bought a piece of hose piping to gas themselves in the car, or whether they've bought a rope and thought about hanging themselves, or whether they have guns at home, or whether they have access to guns, etc. The group of feelings. Most people with depressive syndrome, with major depressive syndrome like this, have distressing feelings, but not everyone. Some people would have major, mostly somatic symptoms or physical symptoms, headache, fatigue, etc. But people do often have, you know, depressive feelings of feeling low and miserable, and everything looks negative and pessimistic. They feel overwhelmed, often guilty, what you might call neurotic guilt, because there's nothing necessarily to be particularly guilty about, but excessive guilt is part of the depressive syndrome. Often indecisive, miserable, disappointed, sad, no confidence in things, losing confidence. The physical symptoms can be multitudinous, and the most common thing that people would present to their GPs with is fatigue, which is obviously a very vague symptom, and GPs worth their salt need to sort out what people complaining of fatigue, what's really going on with them, whether they have a physical illness or whether they have this kind of depressive syndrome. Some people do have just a focus mainly on feeling sick, on feeling tired all the time, having headaches, muscle aches and pains, churning gut, difficulty sleeping, and appetite disturbance are the kind of things that people get. And it feels terrible. Some of you will be familiar with this painting by Munch, which is entitled The Scream. And it feels like that, you know, the shot I showed before of the person sitting on the chair, on the seat, just kind of slumped. People holding their head, I suppose, would be the typical kind of thing that you might picture. People feel like they can't think. They feel headache often. They feel a pain in their head. And when people do suicide with this problem, they don't just get up one morning and decide, well, you know, I'll suicide today. It's to relieve the pain. The intense pain that they experience is so severe that at that time, given that they're thinking in a very negative way about everything, about themselves, their work, their marriage, their family and everything else, and if they haven't presented to anyone and sought any treatment, that's the solution that sometimes people take. Loonig captures it like this. Looking at the television, world misery, thinking human misery, and then it feels like a brick wall has fallen on you. You can't think, everything seems terrible, everything seems negative, etc. But men have a problem addressing these issues, we really do. But I think a lot of men feel ashamed about talking about these kind of issues, about how they feel. And we have this sort of macho man kind of thing there, and this sort of face we hold up to the world that we sort of hide behind. And it's actually a problem with all of medicine, you know. Men won't go and see their GP, whether it's having a prostate examination or whether it's talking about feeling anxious or depressed or whatever it might be. Men are very reluctant to go and see their doctors about these sort of things. The same thing actually applies to doctors. A few years ago, the AMA ran a program about, you know, every doctor should have their own doctor, because a lot of doctors don't have their own doctors. And in fact, if you look at it statistically, doctors and doctors' families get actually worse medical care than your average citizen, because they won't go and talk to people about things. But it's a big problem with men. The perception is that, you know, girls talk, real men don't talk about things, it's girly. It's weak to talk about how you feel. Work and income tend to take priority. One of the coping mechanisms that people often use, of course, is overwork and just immersing themselves in work, becoming more and more withdrawn from people. The perception is that real men don't see doctors, and the ubiquitous "she'll be right, mate" in Australia, which is a problem. Now, we want to make this an interactive kind of evening, so I want to just pause there and see if there are particular issues that people would like to raise, especially there'll be an opportunity to talk about other things at the end of the second half, but I want to have a little break here and just see if there are particular issues that people would like us to address or things they'd particularly like to talk about. I know there's someone here also who's written a book about their own depressive illness experience who might like to make some comments about it at some point.
I have a microphone if anybody wants to speak.
Nervous breakdown is a term that many of us have heard. Where does that fit into what you've said?
Look, it's a common or garden term that people use to cover depressive illness or serious anxiety disorder. I suppose people use it mainly when people get admitted to hospital. A lot of people get admitted to private psychiatric hospitals and use the term sort of nervous breakdown. Covers a multitude of things: schizophrenic breakdown, manic psychosis, depressive episode, major anxiety disorder. And some of those things lead to the others. Some people start off having an anxiety disorder, basically, and if it's untreated, it becomes a secondary depression. Other people have depressive illness, one of the features of which is often marked anxiety. So it's a common garden term. Yep.
Thanks, John. If your mother or father is a depressant, and particularly in our age group, it was never talked about your parents, is it an inherited aspect, and what type of triggers, if it is, can manifest itself?
Mm. Yeah, that's part of what I want to get into actually in the second half, that there are major vulnerability factors, and the best way to look at it is really that some people carry vulnerability factors, and what triggers off episodes of depression and anxiety are certain specific triggers, certain specific stresses. But the vulnerability factors are in fact the major issue, which often people are really not very aware of. At least they don't realise the significance of them. And there are three, essentially: family history, developmental trauma, and certain features of personality and temperament. And we'll get into that in the second half. But I often see people for a standard kind of two-hour assessment, for example, part of which is to clarify what their vulnerability factors are. And I often see people who, when you take the family history, they hadn't realised the significance that half of their family members have got a history of depression or anxiety, sometimes bipolar disorder scattered in there somewhere. And it's a major factor, the inherited vulnerability, because, you know, we are biological creatures as well as being psychological and social and spiritual. We're also biological creatures, and we carry an inherited vulnerability often.
John, thanks for your presentation so far. Sean's my name. We've seen in your presentation, plus the video clip so far, that acknowledgement of the condition of the problem, and also getting professionals involved, and empathy from friends and staff seem to be quite key. But I'm just wondering, from a practical, you know, if I was face to face with a family member or a friend who has admitted to a depressive illness, apart from all those other steps, what could I do to help improve or to support or ameliorate the condition from a practical point of view?
Yeah, well, I mean, they probably wouldn't present, as you say, with a depressive illness. What they would probably do is present with some symptoms, or you become aware that they've got some of the symptoms. And like I've been alluding to, the symptoms need assessment. And you can't actually assess yourself with this kind of thing or you know, as much with any other medical problem much, really. And so that's where the way the Australian healthcare system works, the GP is the coordinator and the central person really in the medical system who does whatever referrals are necessary from that point. So one of the key things is to just acknowledge and to be empathic and to support people, but they really need to be directed to a way of dealing with the problem rather than just kind of sitting with it or bottling it up, and particularly if they've got persistent or serious symptoms, you know? Someone's just got a transient kind of depression or anxiety, well, okay, but if they've got really persistent symptoms, it needs to be assessed properly and then often be referred for treatment. Yeah.
John, yeah, I've got a couple of things I'm interested in following up, and feel free to tell me you're going to cover it later on. But my understanding is there's probably two elements to treatment. Tend to hear both medical and, I guess, a counselling, for want of a better term. So I'm sort of interested in understanding those two sort of dimensions of treatment a bit more. And I'll give my other ones. from a Christian perspective, I have this sense, which is, I'll caveat by saying very not thought out, but I have a sense that there's potentially a bit of a different framework involved compared to maybe the, or what I hear at least, is some of the conventional wisdom. It probably applies more to the counselling side, I imagine.
Yeah, look, I will go into discussing that all of that in the second part. There are essentially actually three elements to a good treatment package, and it really needs to be a treatment package. Aerobic exercise, it turns out, is really very useful for people with anxiety and depression. Lots and lots of research showing that exercise is helpful for people with anxiety and depression. And so we use that now as a key part of the management plan. The second part is psychotherapy of various sorts, and I'll explain there are different kinds of therapy, and there's a particular kind of therapy we use for people with anxiety and depression. And the third element is medication with some people. Now, who does that varies a lot. General psychiatrists do the medication and the therapy and supervise the exercise. Sometimes people split it between a GP doing the medication and a psychologist doing the psychotherapy. I'll come and discuss that a little bit later because there are some problems with a number of those aspects. But the management needs to be a treatment package, and I'll also talk a little bit about the role of prayer and where that all sort of fits in, because it's an important issue that we get the balance right with these things, and the balance sometimes has got a bit distorted with some of these things.
John, you've got a couple of questions. Bill over here on the right.
Yep.
You've got some questions that came in during the week.
Yeah.
Are you addressing those in the second half? Or
we can take them now if you want.
Or some of them now. Jordan wants to ask a question.
Just two quick ones, John. Does a person with a major depressive illness ever get completely better? And secondly, how bad do your symptoms have to be before you would be diagnosed with a major depressive illness?
Well, it's not just them being bad, but them being persistent. You see, you've got to look at the overview with time. So if we think about it in graphical terms, it's the depth of the episode of depression in terms of the severity, particularly as marked by suicidal thought, but it's also the time length, the time span, and it's the persistence that's the problem, really. And that's the key marker for 2 or 3 weeks is, by definition, kind of a depressive syndrome. Yeah. The other part of your question?
People
do certainly get completely better. But one of the things is that recent research demonstrates that for most people, not everyone, for about 80% of people, it is a relapsing illness, potentially. And people do go on to have further episodes. And that really shapes how treatment needs to be organised, because the conventional wisdom, I guess, used to be, and when I was a medical student, the conventional wisdom was that you treated people for 6 months and then you halved their medication and then you stopped it. But 80% of people who have a fair dinkum major depressive episode will in fact have recurrent episodes. And so the better course of management now is to actually institute preventative management. And there's good evidence that antidepressant medication can help prevent a lot of those episodes of depression which would otherwise occur. So some people do really need and are best managed with ongoing medication, but not everyone.
John, I've got one more from the floor here. We've got two we've got now, but we've got some there. I think we should take some that have been sent in, but also...
To what extent, if any, does a good relationship with a father influence the incidence of depression in younger men? Well, it does. Obviously, you know, developmental experience is crucial to the development of a healthy personality. And children need to feel valued, they need to feel secure, they need a role model of how to be a father, how to be a husband, how to be a man, an adult in this culture. I'm currently seeing a couple where, for the man in this relationship, he's never had a decent role model and they have major marital problems. When you take their history, you know, his father used to beat up his mother and they had a very poor relationship. He's never seen what it's actually like to be a healthy man. It's never seen what it's like to be a good husband. And it's very difficult when you're in that situation. You've got to kind of reinvent the wheel, in a sense. You've got to learn how to be in relation to a partner or in relation to children, etc. You've got to learn how to be without ever having a good role model, and you've kind of got to invent it. people who lose a parent before the age of 11 have a higher incidence of depression. And if a child loses a parent, not physically, but they're in fact not available to them, it's experienced in a sense in the same kind of way that I've lost my father or my mother in a sense if they're not present and they're not a nurturing kind of presence. The other thing about it is that when children have an unavailable parent or deceased parent, they tend to think that it's their fault, that that's the way the mind of the child works. They tend to blame themselves. It induces a pattern of self-criticism and stuff, which is one of the personality features, which is a problem for depressive illness.
Good evening. My name's Ben. I just had a question, if you might be going to cover it later on, but around loneliness and isolation. Many people who've experienced trauma or these types of life experiences have 21st century biomedical care, yet they're experiencing loneliness and isolation and only have paid professionals in their life. And you mentioned earlier about needing a holistic approach, and I just thought you might talk about that a bit.
Yep. Loneliness and isolation is a major problem, particularly with older men. And it's the men who are very isolated. And if they have an illness which is also characterised by pain, having a painful illness and being lonely and isolated are major markers for them having a higher risk of suicide. One of the things I'll get to later is the importance of social networks, is that people need social networks. They need people in their lives. And even relatively minor things, like people going shopping and talking to the shopkeepers who they might have known for a number of years, etc., gives people a little bit of a link of social contact, because some people don't even get that. They're just totally isolated. And yes, it's a major risk factor. Yeah.
John, what's the significance of the time between diagnosing or recognising that you're depressive and seeking treatment?
Well, the importance of it is if it doesn't happen, is if people go on having, you know, an untreated condition, which is potentially a lethal condition, or if not lethal, it induces a tremendous amount of suffering, you know, and people separate sometimes in the context of depressive illnesses, because when you get really depressed, everything looks bleak, you know, people resign jobs, I can't do it, I'm not good enough, they separate from people, they get estranged from their children. There are all kinds of things that can happen if they have untreated depressive illness. And so one of the messages, I guess, tonight is to be to recognise if you or friends or family have this kind of difficulty and to start talking to someone about it and eventually, hopefully, wind up with a good GP to get assessment put in train.
So I'd like to go through the main take-home messages from the second part tonight. We've got about another 50 minutes or so, and we'll allow some time for questions, etc. The take-home messages. Serious depressive symptoms need a serious assessment, and I'm not talking about people with mild or minor depressive symptoms, but people who really have got serious and distressing symptoms. The way the Australian healthcare system works, there's a need to see a good GP in the first instance to maybe get a referral, maybe not. The GP needs to suss the situation and get a referral to a good psychologist or a general psychiatrist. Medicare does rebate consultations. I want to have a word about that because a lot of people have misunderstandings about all of that. Treatment for serious depression is available. It doesn't work 100% of the time, but where it doesn't produce a remission, it produces a relief of distress. The best treatment is a treatment package including aerobic exercise, talking therapy of various sorts that we'll look at, sometimes also medication, not always medication. Doctors don't always medicate. The best psychiatrists do psychotherapy and sometimes medication. Prayer is important, but it is not a substitute for good professional management in my experience. I'll tell you a couple of stories about that. Okay, so we look at the causative factors in depressive illness. It's best thought of as being two groups of issues, vulnerability factors and triggering or life event stress. And the vulnerability factors, as I touched on before, are three basically. Genetic, biochemical, which we basically have accessed through people's family history. Some of the genes that do predispose people to depressive illness, to mood disorders, have been identified, but we don't have access to those tests in daily sort of clinical practice. Second group is developmental damage, trauma growing up, emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse. I've got to say, some people have horrendous stories of the way they have experienced their childhood. Things that they wouldn't just tell you about, you know, in a casual relationship, but some people have horrendous stories of the damage that has been inflicted on them. And thirdly, personality features, certain kinds of features of temperament or personality, some of which ensue from the developmental experience, some of which ensue from what one might have inherited genetically. Then the triggering things are life event stresses, which may be a particular grief or a change one's life, or a role change, or some sort of conflict. Can be variety of things. So when you come to assess and look at someone with this situation, what do you actually do? Well, I thought it would be helpful just to lay out what GPs do, what psychiatrists do in terms of assessment of this kind of thing. There's an assessment of the psychological syndrome. Psychiatric diagnosis is pattern recognition, so there's a need to get a good history of what the pattern of these symptoms has been. Look at what sort of features of temperament or personality people have, look at what kind of physical illness they have. And there can be interplay in both directions. Various sorts of physical illness can produce depression, and depression can also produce various physical illnesses, because we are, in fact, contrary to popular myth, we are an integrated entity. We are biological, psychological, social and spiritual, and splitting those things is a problem which was introduced by Greek thought, really, the psyche and the soma, a long time ago, and it bedevils modern medicine to this point. We are, in fact, integrated creatures. Then there's a question of, does a person need or want a referral to see a specialist, a psychiatrist or a psychologist? And there are various management options. Now, just to touch on the referral thing, I mean, someone spoke to me during the break about having difficulty in getting their GP to provide a referral, and said the GP just sort of laughed off the request. And I've heard that on a number of occasions, not all that often, but I certainly do regularly hear people saying that their GP didn't want to give them a referral to a psychiatrist or a psychologist and kind of laughed it off. Now, people have got, medical practitioners too, have got their own sort of personality issues, and some of them, some GPs, I don't know whether any GPs here or not, but the fact of the matter are, some GPs are more psychologically minded than others. And one of my GP colleagues puts it as the rule of thirds. He says that a third of GPs are interested in GP psychiatry. They see it as an integral part of good general family medicine care. A third of them will do it if they have to, and a third of them won't touch it with a barge pole, and they don't even recognise when something's going wrong. And if a GP won't provide a referral, they need to be pressed about it, and if they won't provide a referral, in my book, you see another GP. You've got to have a GP who understands the totality of your issues in healthcare. Brief assessment then includes what the present difficulties are, and including suicidality risk, a person's past psychiatric history, do they have a history of these sort of episodes happening before, family history, personality features and style and mental status examination. And I guess that kind of overview is also characteristic of a psychiatrist doing a proper general assessment. Some counsellors just kind of start, you walk in the room and they just kind of start off, well, how do you feel kind of thing. To do a really proper assessment of anyone's difficulties, you do need to know about the past history, and that's why it takes an hour or two really to do a proper assessment. What sort of personality features are we concerned about? Well, people who are particularly introverted, hypersensitive, people who are very perfectionistic, very self-critical, very unassertive, or worriers are the main kind of features of temperament or personality which are risk factors. And then in management, there is a need to get the balance right. It comes down to what is a person, which is, if you want to put a theological term to it, it's the theology of personhood. What is a person? And a person is a biological entity, but is also a psychological and a social and a spiritual entity. And contrary to popular myth, they are in fact integrated. So it's important really to get the balance right. And when we come to treatment, it's very important to get the balance right, because people overbalance in all kinds of directions. There are some people who try and treat these sort of difficulties with just medication. And so, regrettably, I find there are some psychiatrists who just give people medication.
and they just see people for a series of 10-minute appointments. And that just doesn't cut it, as far as I'm concerned. You can't treat this kind of problem just giving people medication. Everyone needs some form of therapy, either by the psychiatrist or by a psychologist or someone. Some people overbalance in the psychological direction, and they think, oh, it's all just about counselling. You've got to have counselling. Don't ever have medication. And there are a few psychologists around, unfortunately, who say, no, you should just have counselling. You shouldn't ever take medication. And if you've got a mild or moderate problem, you can get away with that. If you've got a severe problem, you can't get away with that. And you may well find that you get some of the more serious complications. You can overbalance in the social direction. We went through a phase a few years ago when we had all the old inpatient units, the old asylums, shifted into the community. A little bit under the influence of some people who thought that the whole thing about mental illness was just social pressure and social difficulties. And people can also overbalance in the spiritual direction and say, well, you know, it's all spiritual. You should just have enough faith. And, you know, if you have enough faith, these problems will all go away. I sometimes relate the tale of a young woman whom I saw a number of years ago who had a child with leukemia. She had a child who was 6 or 7, as I remember. And her parents-in-law were very kind of inflexible sort of Christian people. And they had a view that they put to her that if she prayed hard enough, her child would be healed of the leukemia. And the child wasn't healed of the leukemia and died. And that young woman has had a most difficult relapsing depressive illness ever since. She was my patient for a while. She's then moved on to other people. She's been in and out of hospital over many years. She was told something which basically I don't think is true. It's just not true that if you pray hard enough, various sorts of illnesses will just go away. And it had a very unfortunate effect in that situation. Some years ago, I was asked to go and talk at a seminar on healing at a Lilydale church. They were trying to get a balanced approach to healing of various sorts of illnesses, not just psychological illnesses, but physical illnesses. And the thing that started off that desire to do that was that there was a young woman in that church who developed a breast lump, and she went to her small group leader and said, I've got a breast lump, what should I do? And the small group leader said, oh, well, you shouldn't go and see a doctor and have medical treatment. You should just pray about that. And she prayed about it, and she refused referral to a surgeon, and she died of breast cancer and left two young children without a mother. Then the group leader herself got a breast lump, and she went and had surgical treatment and survived. And it split the whole church community about how do we actually approach issues to do with health and have an integrated or balanced approach to health issues. So we do need to get the balance right, and there are factors in each of those dimensions, I think, that are important in recovery from an illness such as major depression. To get to antidepressant use, there are a number of traps in using antidepressant medication. Using it without adequate assessment. In general practice, antidepressant medication is both overused and underused. Now, that might seem like a stupid thing to say, but it is overused and underused. It's overused in the sense that people will rock up with a grief issue or adjustment disorder, like I alluded to before. They don't have a major depressive disorder, but they get given antidepressant medication. Here, take this pill. You know, it's an easy way to get rid of the patient. It seems like an easy solution. It may not be what the patient actually needs, because they may need some counselling or some therapy and not medication. But people who have really got a fair dink of major depressive illness are often undertreated in general practice. They're often given, take a half a tablet of this or one tablet of that, and the doses of their medication is not adjusted correctly and they end up being undertreated. Giving people prescriptions without preparation of the patient is an issue. I won't go on about that. Giving people tranquilizers without the use of antidepressant medication in the past, particularly say in the 70s or 60s and 70s, a lot of people were given Valium, diazepam, to treat major depression. It doesn't treat depression, and so a lot of people got inappropriately kind of hooked or dependent on some minor tranquilizers when they really actually had a depressive illness and were treated inappropriately. And as I've said, using antidepressant medication without any counseling or therapy component is a trap. Types of therapy. All counseling is not the same. There are three basic types of therapy. There is supportive therapy for symptom relief or counselling,
which is what all counsellors and most psychologists do, is a supportive kind of therapy. It's supportive and it's useful and it can be very helpful, but it doesn't actually address some of the temperament or personality changes that need to be addressed often in people with depression and anxiety. At the other end of the spectrum is intensive therapy, which grades into psychoanalysis, which is really only used for people with major personality damage, people who've had lots of abuse during their childhood years, particularly sexual abuse, but not just sexual abuse. It tends not to be that useful for people with ordinary depression and anxiety. For depression and anxiety, people need a kind of what's called interpersonal psychotherapy or cognitive behaviour therapy, which seems like it's actually the best kind of therapy, which looks at the way people's coping mechanisms work, which is mainly actually the way we think. It's the way we think about ourselves, other people and the world, those three things that make people often vulnerable to depressive episodes, especially if they carry those vulnerability factors that I've referred to. And the kind of model of the cognitive therapy is essentially this. Someone would be in a situation, situation A, they have a way they think about that situation, which typically in people who are prone to depression or anxiety is often a very negative kind of way of thinking. I won't go into elaborating all of that. There's a whole lot of different kinds of negative thinking, which can then generate problems with depression or anxiety. And it's that kind of B step that is the important thing to use to go into in cognitive therapy. And you get people to journal. I get people to do cognitive therapy in a written form, which really helps them to clarify the way they think. And there are particular kinds of thinking which you want to particularly try and change to help to reduce their vulnerability to this kind of problem. Given that you can't actually change your vulnerability factors, you can't change your biological inheritance, you can't change what may have happened to you in terms of childhood abuse, you can't change your essential temperament or personality features that you get to 20 or so with. So there's a need to use these measures. I thought I'd show you a PET scan, positron emission tomography scan, where you can actually map what is happening with brain function. And what is done is to use a radioactive hydrogen isotope to tag it to glucose, and you can see how a person's brain is actually functioning by looking at glucose metabolism. Now, the scan on the left is someone who is depressed. The scan on the right is after they've been treated and they're not depressed. So you can see there is a difference in the way the person's brain functions. A major depressive illness is a brain disorder, as well as having the other components to it. It affects your brain tissue, which is both a biological thing and an electrical thing and a psychological thing and a biochemical thing. It's a very complicated computer. But you can see the changes that have occurred in after treatment. One of the things that's been very useful just in the last few years is that it's now been demonstrated that not only can you get that change with medication, but actually having good psychotherapy produces the same change. And so if people are able to utilise therapy, you can get a similar kind of change with treatment. So then we get to issues particularly for Christians. Now, I've alluded to the theology of personhood thing. It might seem like a long terminology, but it's actually very important to get the balance right between understanding that we are biological, psychological, social and spiritual entities. And if you want to think theologically about medical care or engineering or how a motor car works, all these things are general revelation. You know, special revelation is to do with the pathway to salvation. Other knowledge about how the world works, theologians called general revelation. And medical knowledge is part of general revelation. Fears of treatment that often people have are unrealistic. People have got all kinds of fears, particularly men, have all sorts of fears about seeing doctors and about treatment. They're often unrealistic, they're often distorted, which can become a big problem in them benefiting from treatment. I have a young man who's seeing me at the moment who's got really quite severe obsessive compulsive disorder. He's had to give up a university course. It took him the other day 7 hours to eat his dinner because he's obsessing about whether the knife and fork are contaminated and he can't progress until he's done various rituals to actually get to eating his dinner. And he, at the moment, is refusing to have medication treatment, and we're trying to do cognitive therapy with him,
which, because he has such a severe problem, is not having that much effect. And he's going to be severely affected by this problem if he will not at least have a trial of the usual medication that one uses with obsessive compulsive disorder. Some preaching, I'm afraid, about these sorts of issues is misguided. I have heard, particularly at a church that I formerly attended, the minister preach against the use of antidepressant medication. And really, that's kind of a bit ignorant, really. We live in a modern world where, hopefully, with the influence of things like Beyond Blue and various other kinds of education sort of programs, people are understanding more about mental health issues and depression, etc. And to say to people that you shouldn't take antidepressant medication is not that smart, I don't think. Some years ago, we had a big problem in psychiatry with pastors, particularly of a certain sort of segment of the Christian community, telling people who had schizophrenia that they should stop their medication. And so what used to happen is that people would go psychotic, they'd go quite crazy in common language, they'd go into hospital, they'd be put on medication, the whole thing would settle down after a period of some weeks, they'd be discharged back home again, their pastor would tell them they should stop their medication. They'd go psychotic again after a period of time, they'd go back into hospital again. And they used to go through this sort of revolving door kind of thing. Now, fortunately, we don't see so much of that now because I think people have got a better understanding of how these things work. But every now and then it kind of still pops up. Some people believe that most psychiatrists and psychologists are anti-Christian. That's not actually the case. There are a lot of people in psychiatry who are Jewish, actually. A lot of them had people who were killed during the Holocaust. Quite a high percentage of Jewish people in the psychiatric community. I've been pleasantly surprised, actually, about the way this kind of issue is in the psychiatric community. I worked as a physician. I trained as a physician initially and worked for a number of years at the Royal Melbourne in the renal unit there. And one of the things that I was concerned about training in psychiatry, was sort of this issue as to whether how much it was kind of anti-Christian. And I found to my enjoyment that it's not actually. There are a few people who are anti-Christian in psychiatry and psychology, but actually not that many. Treatment for depression does not aim to make you happy. The medication is not happy pills. The purpose of therapy is not to make you go out of the session feeling happy, but to relieve suffering. It's to help people to be as normal as possible. It's not a happiness exercise. Antidepressant medication is not addictive. Some people seem to think that antidepressant medication is addictive. It's a common belief. It's not actually the case. Some people, when they stop or reduce the dose of an antidepressant, get some minor discontinuation symptoms, but that is not addiction. Addiction is escalating doses of a substance and drug-seeking behaviour, and you don't see that with antidepressant medication. Sometimes people are faced with the choice of, well, do I see someone who's got a Christian background or do I see an expert practitioner? And I've got to say, I would vote for them seeking the expert practitioner most of the time, because the psychiatric treatment is not primarily about issues to do with faith. Faith sometimes arises, as I'll get to in a moment, but it's not the actual core of the treatment, which is about psychotherapy, about those features of temperament and personality, and sometimes about the use of medication. Prayer is important, but in my view, is not a substitute for good treatment. It will be helpful to pray to accept that there is a problem. We men have a problem particularly with acceptance, tend to be head in sand, let's use a lot of denial, let's pretend that she'll be okay. If you've got a serious depression, that's not usually going to be the case. There's a need to accept there is a problem, and it will be helpful to pray for a willingness to have the courage actually to seek assessment and treatment. I sometimes say to people who are having ongoing therapy that I admire people who've had ongoing therapy, because it's a courageous thing to actually come once or twice a week or once a fortnight or whatever over a prolonged period and have the guts actually to look at yourself and the way you function and see whether there are some aspects of the way you function which are not actually that healthy and be willing to look at changing some of those things. It's helpful to try to get insight to use talking therapy. People vary in their psychological mindedness. Some people have got good psychological insight and they can see the way they think about things and so on. Others, it's a real struggle. They have trouble sort of getting it. And there's a need to be persistent with treatment for this kind of thing.
Sometimes we see a reluctance to accept referral because for most people, depressive symptoms are frightening. People don't know what's happening to them. They think it's stigmatising. It has in the past been, I think, much more stigmatising than it is now. There's been a lot of people in the public kind of domain who've said, you know, I've got problems with depression. I remember Gary McDonald was one of the first ones, the guy who was in Mother and Son. He had a major breakdown and was in hospital in Sydney for a period of time. It's well known. He says that he's been a Beyond Blue ambassador. Not as stigmatising as it used to be. Antidepressants are thought of by some people as being a failure if you need to take medication, but it's actually no more a failure than taking Ventolin for asthma or taking blood pressure medication or taking medication for diabetes or whatever, because this kind of serious illness is an illness. The concept of psychotherapy is often confusing for people. They don't know what is going to happen. They think, you know, you walk into the room and you've got to lie down on the couch. Well, most therapy is not done on couches anymore. Some people are afraid of sort of handing over their will to other people as if the therapist is going to tell you what to do every minute of your life. It's not like that. That's not what happens. But some people are frightened to accept referral for specialist treatment. I wanted to say something about ongoing management because recent research has shown that 80% of people who have a major depressive episode will in fact have relapses. And so there's 20% of people who never have another episode, but 80% will have relapses of varying severity. They may be quite severe, they may not be severe. One of my most difficult patients at the moment is a woman who's had 8 relapses of major illness, and she gets really very sick each time and takes, you know, sometimes about 6 months to recover from each episode. That is the sort of situation where you often need to use ongoing medication, sometimes a combination of medications, and there is good evidence that for many people that reduces both the severity and the frequency of depressive relapses. It doesn't work for everyone, and there are some people where you have to just default into a sort of a supportive therapy mode because you can't get the person into a remission. But we now think of it as in terms of remission, like you do with a cancer of various sorts, that the treatment is aimed at getting the person into remission, and we think about a major depressive episode in the same way. It requires a disease management approach, like hypertension or diabetes or asthma. And we were talking about GPs there before. One of the things that's changed a little bit in general practice, I think, is that a lot of GPs kind of think about themselves as like a mini emergency department, and they're just kind of band-aiding something and here, do this, and this will help you to feel better today or tomorrow or next week or something. And not that many GPs are willing to accept the responsibility for ongoing management of someone, that they need to see this patient once a month or once every 6 weeks or once every 2 weeks or whatever, and take responsibility for a continuity of care. And that's also become a problem where there are clinics where there are GPs in and out all the time. They just do a few sessions and, you know, you make an appointment and you might see a different person for each of 3 appointments. And so there's a need to plan very carefully, so you need to see the same doctor, because seeing different doctors each time, they haven't got a hope of actually understanding what you were like last time and being able to pick up subtle changes as to whether someone's better or someone's worse. So it does require a disease management approach, the same as other general medical kind of problems. And there are then sort of 3 phases of treatment. There's the acute treatment to get the person better and get them well again. But then there's the second phase of preventing relapse. And then thirdly, preventing future recurrence. Now, I wanted to say a couple of things about how the Australian healthcare system works, because there's a lot of misunderstanding about the way things operate. The way it works is that the GP is the point of first call. The GP is the coordinator of the Australian healthcare system. Now, that's different from the way it is in the US. Health insurance is organised differently in the US, but one of the things there is that you can just decide what cardiologist you'll have, or what respiratory physician you'll have, or what psychiatrist you'll have. If you see a psychiatrist, in fact, most of the time in the US, you'll only get 3 appointments, mind you. But it's set up differently in Australia, which has got some real benefits, because the GP is the filterer. The GP assesses. If someone presents with fatigue, well, what is wrong with this person? Have they got, you know, anemia? Have they got an underactive thyroid gland? Have they got a depressive illness? Have they got diabetes? There are 101 different things that someone can have when they just present with fatigue. And that's part of the GP's role, is to filter all that And then they may refer in different directions to various medical or surgical specialists, including psychiatrists, and may refer to psychologists for assessment and treatment. But that's so people need a GP's referral to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist. That's the way the healthcare system works. If you don't do that, you don't get your Medicare rebate back. So that's why people need to see a general practitioner for starters. Consultations with private doctors and psychologists are rebated by Medicare up to a certain point. With psychologists, it's only 10 sessions. For psychiatrists, it's more or less unlimited. But it's rebated by Medicare. Some people think that if you see a private practitioner, a private psychiatrist, that it's something to do with private healthcare. Private healthcare is basically to do with inpatient hospital care plus various ancillary things, but it's essentially to do with inpatient hospital care. And so if you see any medical specialist in their rooms, it's rebated through Medicare. I've seen doctors as patients who didn't understand that. They thought it was something to do with their private health insurance. So important to understand that. Rules for good mental health. Okay, so firstly, select your parents very, very carefully. Secondly, ensure there is no emotional, physical or sexual abuse when you're growing up. And thirdly, be very careful of what features of temperament you might inherit. Now, the point obviously is that these are the three vulnerability factors over which you have absolutely no control. So the main vulnerability factors for depressive illness is the things that, over which you have no control, basically. You inherit by various means, either genetic inheritance or you experience by your development, most of the vulnerability sort of factors that are problems in relation to depression and anxiety. But other things, I mean, so various people have asked, well, what can you do, you know, when someone's got these difficulties? Having a supportive partner or supportive friends is really important, and it's one of the things that I actually recognise that I've done really badly. I've spent great hunks of my life studying for postgraduate qualifications, and I've neglected my friendship network, unfortunately, and it's something that I'm consciously doing now, of going and picking up friendships with people that I knew through medical school and in various other places. And refreshing those friendships, because I have not been very good at that, and I think probably a lot of men are not very good at that. There's a need to have supportive friends, and when you have a few friends, get more friends, because one of the risk factors for depressive illness, particularly in later life, is isolation, as has been mentioned. Important to find the best work niche for your personality style. I've had three medical careers so far. To get the right niche for myself, and I guess you know, increasingly the way the workforce is these days, you know, younger people these days are going to have 7 or 8 or 10 different kind of mini careers, which is probably good. It's different from perhaps how it was 30, 40 years ago when you trained as an engineer and you're an engineer forever kind of thing. And it's really important to find the right work niche. Some years ago, I saw a Salvation Army officer, a female Salvation Army officer, as a patient, who'd been told by the Salvation Army to go from A to B. And she was very obedient, as all Salvation Army officers are. It's run like a military organisation. The only problem is that they put her, she was a round peg in a square hole, and they put her in something that just she wasn't suited for and she couldn't do. And she became really quite depressed. And so finding the right niche for oneself is really important. Realistic goal setting, work-life balance, finding a balance between work and life, sorting out faith issues. A lot of people, I guess, roll along with not knowing what they think about this or that, not really finalising sort of what they think in terms of faith issues. Belonging to a faith community, which is going to help to provide some of those social contact needs. And I've only been at ALFS for a couple of years, so I belonged to a previous church for 38 years prior to that. And one of the things I've noticed about coming to ALFS is that, you know, it is a very friendly church by and large. But a lot of what happens is, in fact, facilitating good social and friendship contact, which people need. It's really important. Keeping short accounts with God, fessing up when things go a bit pear-shaped, and facing up to issues, I think, is a really important issue in terms of good mental health. Getting a good GP who will listen. And as I said, I was talking to someone before whose GP wouldn't refer them. If your GP doesn't listen or if they won't refer, get another GP. We have a short list of GPs who've referred a lot of patients to us over the last 20, 25 years that I often do reverse referrals for. You know, when people have problems with their GP, I give them, you know, here's a list of 4, 5, 6 general practice clinics who run good clinics. They don't just do, you know, 6-minute bulk billing medicine. They will actually see you for extended periods of time if you need that, etc. And if your GP isn't cutting the mustard, particularly in terms of psychological aspects of GP psychiatry, there's a need to get another one. And there's a need to see your GP, given the way the Australian healthcare system works. If a person is unwell in any way, we're not in a position to assess what the problem is. If you have, for example, fatigue, it's something that requires an assessment to see, well, is this a physical thing, or is it primarily a psychological thing, or is it a combination of the two, or whatever. These things need careful assessment, and someone who's got persistent depression also needs careful assessment. Talk things over with people. Often, don't self-treat with alcohol. If someone recommends that you accept a referral for good assessment or specialist treatment, accept that. With a second opinion, if necessary, if you're not happy that you're not getting a sort of a good overview of something, get a second opinion. Second opinions are readily available. I always refer my most serious patients to a senior colleague for a second opinion, and there's no problem for doing that with good practitioners. There are a few people who don't like to consult with other people. Some of them have got rather idiosyncratic views about things. Good practitioners will always accept a second opinion. So then we get to resources. Now, suggested reading, there are a number of books around. If you go into any bookstore, they'll often have quite a big section of self-help stuff. There's lots of stuff about the management of depression and anxiety, most of which is okay. A lot of stuff to do with couples therapy is very twee, I think, a lot of the sort of commercially available things. But most of the books around on depression and anxiety are useful, with a few exceptions. Sarah Edelman's book called Change Your Thinking is a good one that's been used in recent years. Beating the Blues by Tanner and Ball has been around for a number of years. And Feeling Good by David Burns, who's a psychiatrist who's been very involved with the development of cognitive therapy. That's been around for a long time. A little yellow book that many of you may have seen from time to time. That's a really good resource also, and mainly focuses on cognitive therapy and how that sort of operates. Other sort of links, I've put several links here which are copied on the handouts outside for different purposes. The Australian College of Psychiatrists there on the top has got a referral directory, which is something that I actually initiated 20 years ago when I was the chair of the Victorian branch. A lot of GPs don't know what psychiatrists do what, they don't know how to contact them, etc. And so we developed a paper-based referral directory some 20 years ago, which then became electronic and then became national, and it's now a national referral directory which sits on the front page of the College of Psychiatrists website, ranzcp.org. It's not passworded. It used to be passworded, but it's not passworded now. And you can dial in the kind of thing that you want to see someone about, let's say mood disorder, depression. You can put in your suburb or your postcode. You put in whether you want to see a female, whether you want to see a male, adult or child or whatever, and it will trot out a list of people, of practitioners who work in that kind of field. But it's also useful, I think, too, if you've got a good GP in particular, to suss out from the GP who have they found are good practitioners when they refer. And good GPs have a handful of urologists, psychiatrists, physicians, surgeons or whatever that they know who are good and who they've referred to over many years, and they should be able to give anyone 2 or 3 names anyway. The second site there is the Australian Psychological Society, psychology.org.au, where you can do the same thing with a psychologist referral directory. And some people with these sort of difficulties are managed by a GP together with a psychologist rather than a psychiatrist. Occasionally a psychiatrist does the medication and a psychologist does the therapy, but a lot of general psychiatrists do their own therapy, and I personally think that's actually the best way to manage, is to do your own psychotherapy and use medication yourself rather than have it done by two different people, because it immediately creates a communication problem because you're not really quite sure what's going on in the other sessions. And it really is best managed as an integrated way. The Beyond Blue website is there. That has also got lists of psychiatry, psychology-friendly GPs. GPs who have listed themselves that they have an interest in general practice psychiatry and psychology They're familiar with these issues and they're good GPs to see for these kind of psychological, psychiatric problems. The American Psychiatric Association is the next one. There's lots of good e-brochure information on the APA site. The bottom site is my own consulting room's website, and some of this information is on that site. In emergency, one's GP, Lifeline, Beyond Blue, 000, if there's some kind of acute emergency, are the best ways to proceed. So, before we have some Q&A, I want to just go through the take-home messages again. There is a difference between depression as a symptom and persistent depressive illness. Many men cover up with work and alcohol, and depressive illness can have very serious outcomes. 15% mortality rate, it's a serious problem potentially. There is a mixture of physical and psychological symptoms. It is a syndrome, a grouping of different kinds of symptoms. And there is a need, particularly for men, to get used to talking to someone about it initially, friend, pastor, etc. See one's GP. The first take-home message is there. So then serious depressive symptoms need a serious assessment. See a good GP in the first instance. If the GP you're seeing is not a good GP, suggest get another one. And consider referral to a good psychologist or general psychiatrist. And the same applies to psychologists and psychiatrists. You know, there are people you click with, there are people you don't click with. There are good practitioners, there are not so good practitioners, as in any field. And so if things are not going well, seek a second opinion or arrange to be referred to see someone else. Medicare rebates consultations. Contrary to popular myth, private practitioners' care is not rebated through private health insurance unless you're actually in hospital. Treatment for serious depression is available. There's a need to get the balance for that between the physical, the psychological, the social and the spiritual. The best treatment is a package, exercise, a form of talking therapy crafted for the individual, sometimes medication. Prayer is important, but it's important not to get it out of balance and to coordinate it with good professional care. So they're the main headlines and the messages. We have some time for some questions, and perhaps, Bill, you might want to just
We've had a number, John, have come in. I'll read some of them have been addressed, I think, in your talk this afternoon. I'll just go through them, though. Can you become dependent on antidepressants? Well, I think you've covered that point, haven't you?
Not dependent. Dependence is, you know, escalating doses and I can't stop this medication. That is different from needing a medication. I mean, I've got asthma. I need to take Ventolin. Now, am I dependent on the Ventolin? Well, not in a pathological sense. If I don't take my Ventolin, I'll be wheezing. But if I take the Ventolin, I'm not wheezing. Now, that's treatment for an illness. It's not dependence in any sort of pejorative or negative sense.
What is the best way to help someone who refuses to admit their mental health circumstances to their wife?
Subtly keep at it. Be empathic, be supportive. Don't criticise or beat people up. I saw a young man during the week who perceives his parents to be quite critical. I saw his parents separate from him. They are a bit critical. They don't realise they're critical, but they are. And people in that situation need to learn to be supportive and empathic. If someone will get into therapy, there are ways that the partner or family can be involved in the therapy. Particularly in cognitive behaviour therapy, you sometimes involve the family in various ways with tasks to do in between appointments.
Well, I think this question, John, is somebody asking, they know some. My reading of this is they're asking, they know somebody who won't admit their mental health circumstances to their wife, so what do they, as a friend, do?
All one can do is be empathic and supportive and look for opportunities to encourage people to seek proper treatment and through their GP in the first instance. If there is an emergency arise, as it occasionally does, the public sector CAT teams are available to see people at home and they will do that. If someone takes an overdose or cuts themselves or attempts to hang themselves or whatever, you can go to take people to an emergency department of any general hospital and access treatment through there. CAT teams see people in that situation and the person can be referred to a private practice psychiatrist for ongoing care afterwards. Sometimes people need to be admitted and they're admitted via the CAT team to the psych unit at Box Hill or Maroondah or the Royal Melbourne or whatever.
Can you comment on homosexuality and depression?
No, not really. I mean, It's a very vexed issue what homosexuality actually is. I think current best informed opinion is that it's something to do with the biochemical environment as a person develops, probably in utero. There are abnormalities that are apparent in the brains of people who have homosexual orientation, which are different from the average normal person in the population. And such an orientation seems to be unchangeable. It seems to be a fixed sexual preference. It's not something that is sort of open to therapy. The thing about depression depends on the sort of way their homosexual lifestyle is conducted. There are people who are couples living in their community that you probably wouldn't even know were there and who have long-term commitments to each other. There are other people who frequent bathhouses and they have casual homosexual contacts in toilets and public toilets and places like that, who have a much more disordered and irregular kind of way that they live, which probably makes them prone to depression. That's about all I could say about it.
Assuming that your friend does have a major depressive illness and are doing all the right things with seeking medical, psychological treatment, how can you be intentionally supportive in an ongoing manner?
People need what's called a low EE environment. They need a low expressed emotion environment. Various studies have been done about this, and they measure what they call expressed emotion, or EE. In other words, in common parlance, a non-critical environment. No yelling and screaming and criticism and attacks, etc. People need a calm, structured, non-emotional kind of environment with empathic kind of support of the person.
I think you've answered this one, but I'll read it out. What's the definition of a good GP? How do you know they're good? And by the way, you have got a GP in the audience, by the way. If you didn't know.
Yes. I hope what I've said hasn't caused too much offence, but I think it's true, so I have to say it. How do you know if you've got a good GP? Well, in this psychiatric field, I mean, I do get patients feeding back to me from time to time that they requested a referral and they were refused a referral. Now, I think, you know, I'm involved with coordination between the College of Psychiatrists and the College of GPs, and the College of GPs representative, in fact, just wrote a blurb that I read last week saying that good GPs see GP psychiatry as part of ordinary general practice care. And it is part of ordinary general practice care. But some GPs don't get that. Often it's to do with their own sort of personality style. They're just not psychologically minded. And if you are seeing such a person and you've got a prostate problem, they might be fine. Or if you've got some other general medical problem, they might be fine. But some people just don't click with understanding psychological and psychiatric things. And so in this field, if you're not getting your needs attended to, sometimes there is the need to see someone else.
After recommending someone to a GP or psychologist, what is the best way to support them following that?
Yeah. Well, I think I probably...
Yeah, I think probably yeah, I'm just got reading through the questions that are in here, so people know they've been addressed. If you wanted to help people with mental illness only, what job and course would help with these issues? If you wanted to help people with mental illness only, what job and course would help with these issues? Mm. I presume that's somebody wanting to help people with mental illness. What would you... what career would you suggest?
Well, there are various flavours, you know, in the helping professions. I mean, you know, social work, psychology, medical practitioner, psychiatry. There are some people who do volunteer kind of stuff in being, for example, hospital visitors to people who have got to have inpatient care where they sometimes have to be admitted involuntarily. There are public community visitors to units like that. There are public representatives on the Mental Health Tribunal, for example, people in the community who volunteer are able to do that kind of work. So there's a variety of things.
Okay. If a friend is seriously suicidal from a Christian perspective, what should be done and said in terms of convincing them not to suicide?
Well, you see, this is the thing. There isn't a Christian perspective. There is an integrated perspective because we are biological, psychological, social and spiritual. So there's a need to see it as being a serious health problem. It's a serious mental illness problem which has got those various dimensions of the way you can help people and getting them in to have proper assessment and proper treatment. And I encourage people against this dichotomising of things. The psyche and the soma is a real problem. the Christian and the non-Christian treatment is a real problem. The best treatment is integrated treatment, recognising all those different dimensions.
Should depression as a symptom rather than a feeling or disorder be treated or endured? I think that's referring to one of the earlier graphs, so you know, yeah. You talk about the bottom. Yeah.
It depends on the clinical syndrome that it fits into. Is it part of a grief reaction, for example? Grief is a normal human emotional response to loss. It is not a psychiatric illness. Occasionally it can grade into a major depression. Sometimes people get really very sick with a major complicated grief reaction, or it can be an adjustment disorder, but the group that we want to focus on particularly in getting into treatment are the people who've got a major depressive illness, so where the symptoms are persistent and severe for more than 2 or 3 weeks.
What is adjustment disorder?
Adjustment disorder is an adjustment to a life event. So if someone has, let us say, a loss of a job, and they may get quite depressed about that, but it's a fluctuating kind of depression. It may not be a major depressive illness. It's an adjustment to a different life circumstance. Or it might be a separation, for example. Although I've seen people have a major depression after a separation, and it's a most severe depressive illness because they had vulnerability factors. So but that's what an adjustment disorder is. It's an emotional reaction and adjustment to a life event where there's some loss, conflict, disappointment, upset, separation, etc.
What do you think the effects of copycat effect from the media? Is it big enough of a problem not to talk about it as much as we should?
Well, it's big enough of a problem for the media not to put it in the papers all the time. And there is a copycat effect, and that's why they don't do it. But it shouldn't prevent us from talking about the management of depression in a more general sense, and it's important that it doesn't. The copycat thing is, you know, people usually who've got some major emotional disturbance, seeing that someone was killed by coming in front of a train, and they do the same thing.
The last one here, but you still got some from that came in during the week. What is psychotherapy?
Well, psychotherapy is what I described before. It's got those three different types: supportive therapy, mostly counsellors and most psychologists; cognitive therapy, usually clinical psychologists and psychiatrists; intensive therapy, which can also be done by psychiatrists and psychologists and sometimes other people who've trained as psychoanalysts. The type of therapy that is most useful for depression, anxiety, is cognitive behaviour therapy.
So I think you've got some more on there. I know there's one on bipolar.
So one person put a question: I have a friend with bipolar, how can I help him? How do I react to him? Well, the first thing is it bipolar disorder? There are a lot of people around who are said to have bipolar disorder when they actually don't. It's a casual label that's been put on someone by a GP, a friend, someone or other else, without necessarily taking a full history. And there are some people who have basically an anger problem and they get labelled as having bipolar disorder. And a lot of people who have fluctuating depression, because they have mood swings, they're labelled by someone as having bipolar disorder when they actually never have a manic episode. To have a bipolar disorder, you've got to have, if a normal mood is a band like so, depression is dips below the normal mood, and manic is when people have elevations of mood. So in its most gross form, where people are psychotic, where they think they're God's gift to the world, and they're rushing around doing all kinds of things. They can't turn their brain off. They think they're getting messages from Mars, or they've got some, you know, they've discovered how to split the atom in their lounge room or something. You know, they've got an elevation of mood, grand schemes, grand dreams, racing all over the place, being entirely inappropriate in various ways. There's a lady who's been a patient of mine for about 30 years now, who has bipolar disorder, and how it manifested with her was standing up in church and prophesying. She would stand up in church and prophesy about something or other, and people just sort of took her at face value for starters, until I realised it was actually part of her manic disorder, that she was in fact revved up, souped up, she couldn't stop thinking, she couldn't sleep properly, her mood was elevated, she actually had a mood disorder. The rest of the question, yeah, the bipolar one. Acceptance, primarily. People with physical and psychological illness just want to be treated as normally they would be treated. Same applies to people with a serious medical illness. Someone with bipolar disorder, it's one of the more serious types of illnesses. They really need to be in professional treatment. Simple counselling is not going to be effective for people who's really got bipolar disorder. But it's important to not try and be the therapist to such a person. You could be a supportive friend or partner. You can't actually be a therapist to them. But there's a need to be aware with someone who really does have a manic disorder, a bipolar disorder, that the manic symptoms can be widely varied and they can be things that aren't immediately tweaked to. I saw a man a number of years ago who was a quite senior businessman in this town, and he was brought along by his family because he was manic. He was buying up companies and doing all kinds of business deals and stuff and quietly going through the family fortune, which was considerable. And they realised, of course, that he had an illness and he wouldn't accept treatment for it. So in the end, they have to have him certified and have him have legal measures taken to remove him from control of his companies because he had no insight into it and he wouldn't accept treatment.
Is that... That's the... Okay, we've got... It's actually 9:10. If there's any burning issues from the floor that... We haven't had anything, haven't had any extra ones come in on text.
Thanks for your talk. You talked on one slide about preparing the patient to take antidepressants, and I think that's really important as a GP. I thought it might be helpful to talk to the audience about the biochemical rationale for using antidepressants, and I thought, and I'd be interested to know what the evidence is for exercise treating depression and anxiety?
Well, the exercise one for start, there's heaps and heaps of research been done about the usefulness of exercise for anxiety and depression. It's only really usefulness for mild to moderate depressive illness. See the people with the most severe kind of depressive illness, they're not in a fit state to be using exercise, but it's useful for people who've got a mild or more moderate stuff. There is a lot of stuff in the literature about exercise. There's actually a website and an organisation in Melbourne now called Exercise is Medicine, which is promoting the use of aerobic exercise in various sorts of ways. The thing about the biochemistry of mood disorder is not something that we can summarise in 1 minute. The best theory we have is that it's related to the level of serotonin and noradrenaline in the synapses between the nerve cells in the brain meet. Brain is a very complicated structure, and if we think about it as a whole lot of nerve endings which join at a thing called a synapse, and it is thought that it's a change in the serotonin and noradrenaline levels in the space between the synapses, the synapse space between the neurons that is associated with depression. It's not something one of my colleagues and friends was asking before, you know, is there a blood test you can do? There isn't a blood test that you can do for depressive illness. It was thought some years ago by a psychiatrist who worked in Melbourne and then worked in the USA, a fellow called Barney Carroll, that you could do an assessment relating to people's response to cortisone, to dexamethasone. And this was used for some time, but it's turned out to be not a very useful test. And so there isn't actually any biochemical test that we can use. Antidepressant medication is not a panacea. Best guess would be that it helps maybe 70% of people. There are some people that they don't help antidepressant medication. There's some people who need to have ECT. A patient I saw some years ago who was a teacher who was seeing a GP and a psychologist, and she was quietly going psychotic and neither of them noticed. And she went psychotic. She had a depressive psychosis, had to be admitted to hospital, had ECT, which she didn't really understand at the time, had a very good response to ECT and is now perfectly well and is back teaching in her school. In fact, I got a letter from her husband last year thanking me for the help that had been given. I haven't used ECT that much, but some people do need ECT, and medication alone is not sufficient. There are some people who need to default. You need to default to a supportive therapy kind of stance where you can't cure their depression. You can best to do just help them to deal with day-to-day life. In the same as with other general medical problems, you can't cure people's asthma or cure their diabetes or cure their high blood pressure. You can sometimes use medication to reduce the severity of the problems, but you have to default to a supportive position, and sometimes that's what you have to do.
John, are you able to discuss the possible side effects of antidepressant medication, and are there any particular side effects which are common to various types of antidepressant medication?
Yeah, look, it varies widely. There are 7 groups of antidepressant medications, and they all tend to have different kind of side effects. But that having been said, There's a lot of inter-individual variation in the way antidepressant medication affects people. I've got patients who don't have any side effects at all, and I've got other patients who complain bitterly about a half a tablet of anything. So there's just a wide variation. Now, there is a blood test become available just in recent months called DNA dose, which assesses people's metabolic pathways and is now giving us a bit of an idea as to why people respond to certain medications and not others. And that is sometimes a useful assessment that can be done. But it just varies tremendously. You know, if we take, for example, the common example which would often be started with is what's called an SSRI medication. Trade name Zoloft you may have heard of, or Arapax or Prozac, they're all in the SSRI group. Now, some people when they start those medications get a bit of nausea, some people get a bit of headache, most of the time those symptoms go away. Some people find it makes them a bit activated, so they get a bit anxious. Other people find they're a bit sedating. Some people find they're totally neutral. Some people also get sexual side effects from it. They get lack of sexual interest, difficulties with impotence. Perhaps about 50% of men, perhaps about 30% of women. It varies. Sometimes it improves a bit, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's a problem to them, sometimes it isn't. And sometimes you need to change to another medication because of a side effect like that. So it really just varies very widely. This DNA dose test is a bit of a help, but it's not that flash. It's a little bit of a help in terms of knowing what medication is going to suit a person if they do need medication. But there's a long way to go in tailoring the appropriate medication to people.
John, it's been a fantastic evening. A number of people have spoken to me in the interval and said how good it is, and they were looking forward to the second half, and I'm sure they'll feel the same about the second half. I appreciate you giving up the time to do this. You can see by the attendance we've had here, it's nearly 100 people here tonight. And so that's a great turnout. So thank you very much for all your work tonight. I'm sure everybody's appreciated things. I just want to make a couple of comments. You know, depression is in the Bible. We just need to look about how the great apostle Paul was feeling at various times during his ministry and journey. How Elijah coped in the Old Testament after dealing with the prophets of Baal. But what did God do? He didn't say, man up and pull yourself together. And he didn't say, you need to pray more. He provided grace, a care, mercy and understanding. And that is what we need to do for people that are suffering. If you're feeling anxious or depressed, do a self-assessment based on what John has told us this evening. Get medical help. Don't be afraid to go to the doctor. Talk to your friends who you trust about how you're feeling and don't hide it. And remember, it's okay to be not okay. Just watch your friends and look for the signs and challenge them. Do pray for them, but encourage them to talk and get medical help. It's an illness, remember, it's not a weakness. I do want to encourage those of you that are in managerial positions, who've got people working for you. It's really important that you look out for those guys. You know, we are all overworked in our work environment. Everybody, as you heard on the video today, a guy came back to work, the workload didn't change. I would encourage you in the managerial positions to just be aware of that, and guys, and you've heard about some of the symptoms, to think about that. Thanks for coming along. It's great to see so many of you here, as I said, nearly 100 people. And if what you've heard tonight has raised issues for you that you want to talk about tonight, please come forward. John's prepared to see you if you're desperate to talk about something, and you know, I don't take that lightly, but you know, just if you do want to come and talk to John, I'm sure I've asked him and he said he is prepared to talk with you. If it's opened up some sort of past for you and you want to pray about something, there are some of the guys here are prepared to pray with you, and I would encourage you to come forward if you do want some prayer. We're not saying it's the be-all and the end-all, but it's, you know, tonight, if you would like to pray about some of the issues, it may have opened up some old wounds for you. I'd really love to hear feedback. You know, this men's ministry we run here at St. Alfred's is for you guys. It's not for me. It's not for Peter McPherson. It's for you guys. I really would like to have some feedback. All of you that registered online will have got an email back from me. So you've got my email address. But you can actually, if you want to give feedback confidentially, you can use the poll everywhere, exactly the same text system. It'll be open for another a week or so, I think Ian said. So in the next week, if you want to give us some feedback, and I'd really like to hear about that. A big thank you to Ian Lober and his team and the guys that turned up early, and hopefully some of the guys that are going to stay behind tonight to help tidy up. Thanks. It just leaves me to wish you a safe journey home, and thanks for coming. Good night, everyone. Cheers. Oh, sorry.